You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
You know, you say troll on in. Well, or not. I mean, today we're going to talk about maybe not trolling on in. And the fact of the matter is that it's not trolling necessarily, but it is longlining. And some of the things that we hold near and dear to us, like the supply of tuna. We welcome back to the studio from the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, my friend Eric Kingma. Eric is the International Fisheries Coordinator. Boy, man, that sounds like a policeman. You know, in some respects, it kind of is, right?
A little bit, but mostly policy policemen.
Yeah.
But aloha, Uncle Mike.
Aloha. You know, one thing that I think that we need to describe to people is there's always a great deal of, I don't want to say ignorance, but uncertainty on what we're talking about when we talk about big eye and ahi and some of the other tuna species like albacore tombo or like skipjack, aku, and whatnot. Do most of us interchange ahi and big eye? Are they that similar that it's easy to make a mistake?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the marketplace, it's ahi. Mm-hmm. Once it hits the block, pretty much it leaves, it's ahi. It hits the block. Mostly it's big eye in the longline fishery. Mm-hmm. So about 50% of the landings of the Hawaii longline fishery is big eye.
Mm-hmm.
Yellowfin only makes up a small percentage, maybe 10 or 15%. So the most of the ahi that's coming through the block is big eye, but once it hits the market, it's ahi.
One thing that we've come to do over the last year or so on the program is trying to differentiate between local fish, outside fish, and all of this stuff. It's evidentiary, I guess, to pretty much scientifically support that we probably have an indigenous yellowfin tuna ahi population in the Hawaiian Islands, right?
That's right.
Okay. But do we have similarly a big eye population?
We don't really know.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, huh?
It is interesting, given that it's a tropical species. It lives in cooler waters than yellowfin. But there's obvious overlap between those two species. They're really nearly identical. But big eye tend to live a little deeper in the water column mm-hmm. than yellowfin. You know, those big eyes can help them see darker water.
Are you likely on a long line set to get mixed species?
You are, but mm-hmm. the way the fishery operates is that they're deep settings. So the mm-hmm. sag in the net, the deepest point of this, of the deepest hook fish, that sag is probably around, it's over 1,000 feet deep. So
that's pretty interesting.
It's deep. Yeah, it's deep fishing. So guys trolling at the surface, they're really rare to get a big eye just trolling blind. If you're fishing handline off of fad, you can get some big eye.
Then you got a shot.
Yeah.
You know what I think is really interesting? A lot of people don't understand how long line is a long line. In other words, they think that there are 10 million hooks and they're all right next to each other and they're a curtain of death. Just because of the depth, don't these hooks have to be, in many cases, pretty far apart on that line?
Oh, that's right. I mean, I don't know the exact distance between hooks, but it's probably, you know, 20, 30 meters, something like that.
Yeah.
So there's about 2,500 hooks on a line that's set, say, just 30 miles, for example.
Yeah, and what's interesting to that is you want to have them far enough apart so they can't hook each other.
Yeah, or snag.
You know, if they snag each other, they're no good. But I think that simply means that people have no appreciation when they see that line and they think, well, it's a surface line with 30, 40 feet, and then there's a hook. Yeah. These leaders are pretty long for these deep sets.
Yeah, no, I think they're 15 to 20 meter long leaders. And so
plus they're sagging the
they're
line.
Sagging now. Like I said, the shortest or the shallowest hook is probably 100 meters. The deepest hook is 400 meters, so you're looking at over 1,000 feet. And they're fishing so deep that they're in water temperatures, I think it's like 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And so when a big eye dies on the hook, they are preserved basically in cool water. Yeah. That's what keeps their quality.
You need to explain that because one of the things that one of the biggest selling points for big eye is the shape that they're caught in.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that's to do with the quality of the guy actually catching the fish and icing the fish gutting or heading or whatever. But the rest of it is just mama nature.
Yeah, and it's the way and the depth that they're caught at that really preserves the quality of the fish. So they'll, you know, they might fight on the hook for, I don't know, maybe an hour or so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some come up alive too, but they also some die on the hook at the depths of 400 meters, and it's 50 degrees down there. And so when the product comes up, the big eye comes up, it's really
nice and cold.
Yeah. As opposed to, say, you know, surface trolling for an ahi that you're fighting, you know, easily can get burnt. And
sure.
That's the difference in the market between big eye
especially and how they get hooked. That's a great point. Mm-hmm. Now, there's another thing that I don't think people understand, and that is that this long line that we're talking about, as long as it is, it's just not, you don't just throw it in the water and then pick it back up. This is a big operation over several hours.
Yeah, I mean, it takes, you know, just to set the long line, it takes maybe 6 to 8 hours, and to haul comes sometimes maybe 8 to 10.
Yeah, so you're looking at a pretty big labor-intensive type of a deal.
Right.
So even though the setting out is not anywhere near as difficult as the bringing it in.
Yeah, bringing in, you're dealing with, you know, sometimes sharks, you're dealing with other fish, marlins, you know, a big blue will come on and
take,
you know,
that old eye.
And
right?
They got to,
big eye.
The crew's got to fight the fish, you know. They got to get it on board, and sometimes even when they catch swordfish, you're looking at a 400-pound animal sometimes, and they got to
they're not happy.
Yeah.
Okay, now, one of the things that we need to make sure that people understand is whenever there's an article that comes out in the paper about this fishery is closed or that fishery is closed, what does that kind of mean? I mean, right now, for instance, explain where we are right now. We have one part of our big eye fishery is closed.
Yeah, that's right. So the Hawaii longline fishery basically met its United States quota for big eye in the Western Central Pacific on August 5th. So we had a quota of about 3,500 metric tons. That quota has been going down for several years based on international agreements.
Mm-hmm.
This year we met it quite early, and they met it early because it's been a good year for catching fish. Mm-hmm.
Which means for us consumers, it's been a good year because there's been a lot of supply.
A lot of supply. So prices have been pretty good for the consumer. But this year we've seen not much increase in effort in the fishery. So same amount of hooks and boats, basically, but about a 40% increase in catch rates. So the fish had not only been biting more, they're also bigger fish.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had more fish coming through the auction and the block, and we hit our quota early. So we've basically, the National Marine Fisheries Service, the U.S. government, has shut down the Hawaii longline fishery from August 5th from fishing in the Western Central Pacific.
And this closure is for how long?
The closure is until the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. Calendar year.
Yeah, the end of the calendar year. Except the council, the Western Pacific Fisheries Council, we have an amendment to our Pelagics Fishery Ecosystem Plan that allows the U.S. territories of American Samoa, Guam, Sinemai, mm-hmm. You know, the Saipan, to transfer some of that quota to the Hawaii longline fishery under some really strict rules.
Okay, I want to get into explaining a little of that, but I also want to maybe set the groundwork so people really get it, that those quotas in that other part of the fishery, they're also based on sustainable yield and not further endangering the condition of the stock.
That's right. So, you know, the council went through a pretty scientifically rigorous process and analytical approach to basically, in order to allow these transfers, they can't, you know, impede international big eye conservation objectives. They're all sort of consistent with the Magnuson-Stevens Act in terms of our obligations to take into our account relative impact of U.S. fisheries on big eye stock. As you know, big eye is part of a pan-Pacific population. Is sort of managed internationally between the West and in the East. And that line of demarcation is about 200 miles to the east of Hilo.
Yeah,
it's 150 degrees west.
That's a huge
longitude.
Piece of ocean.
Yeah.
You know, does it even amaze you, even in the scientific world, to realize how much fish are out there? I mean, that's a lot of fish out there.
Right. So last year, 2014, the statistics are such that the Western Central Pacific Ocean, and that's west of that 150-degree mm-hmm. longitude line, right? So that includes, you know, Hawaii all the way to basically almost the South China Sea, includes Indonesia, Philippines, that area in the Pacific. 3 million metric tons of tuna were landed last year, which is the world's largest tuna fishery.
Lots and lots of fish.
Lots of tuna.
Okay, now, I think that what you explained earlier is we've been in a blessed season. Big fish, plenty of them, good price.
Mm-hmm.
As always now, we're looking towards the fall, and then we're looking towards the holidays when the demand is high and the supply is low. Where is our fleet currently able to fish?
Right, so they're able to fish in the Eastern Pacific, And that's that east of 150 degrees west longitude line I referred to, which is from here, it's about 450 miles.
I was going to say, it's a longer trip.
Longer trip. Yeah, yeah. So you have longer trips, days at sea. The quality of the fish maybe aren't that good this time of year over there. And so the quality could be poorer, and you could get less quality fish at the market. But the problem is that consumers might still be paying a high price for that fish because 20% of the fleet are restricted from fishing in that area because we've reached a quota that applies to large vessels over about 78 feet. So we've reached that quota too, and that part of the fishery or fleet was closed around August 12th. So we're in a situation about 20% of the Hawaii longline vessels can't fish at all right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's 20% of the market.
Yeah, but there's another thing. And it seems ironic to me that the smaller boats are the only ones that can go now, and they're the ones that have the biggest trouble going there.
Absolutely. So, some of those boats may not go either. And if they don't go, that just means more reduced supply in the market. And to the consumer, you're gonna be ending up paying more for potentially lower quality fish. And it's not just lower quality U.S. fish, but you're also, because you have a little bit of a supply gap, you're going to be getting some more imports.
Mm-hmm.
And those imports are, we know they're not as fresh. They're not as good as a Hawaii cod.
Well, there's all kinds of things. There's people worried about what they call tailpipe ahi and all of this other stuff. You really don't know that. But I think what would be interesting is that people should know, and I won't hold you to the numbers because I know that's not your area of expertise, but let's talk about an independent longline guy, a guy that owns his boat, he has a crew and he has his gear, what it costs him to go fishing. In not just in time, but in fuel and in bait and everything else. So before you decide to go that 450 miles, you have to be reasonably certain you're going to catch some fish because you're spending a lot of money to go catch fish.
Yeah. So you're looking at the costs are fuel.
Yep.
Which is associated with oil. You got to have oil. Mm-hmm. You got to have, diesel. You got to have bait.
Yep.
You got to have ice.
Yep.
You got to have groceries.
Yep.
And you got to have labor.
Yep.
And then you have vessel insurance.
You have the, by the way, do you own your boat? Do you have a mortgage on your boat?
So leaving the harbor, looking at a bill for, deep set tuna fishing, $30,000.
Right. Now, you do not always make $30,000 when you come home. And this is like, we've had such a fascination, as you know, on the program in the last couple of years with the Wicked Tuna guys. And they are a Manini expense outgo in comparison to our guys. I mean, they have fuel, they have ice, they have bait and everything else, but they're not out for 20, 30 days at a time. And they're not going 400 miles to catch their fish.
That's right. So this fishery is, we're at the edge here. We're out in the middle of nowhere, and we luckily have access to international waters around Hawaii. So we can basically follow the fish, and that's a great advantage, but it also comes at a cost because you're always looking for that fish out there. And sometimes seasonally, in the wintertime, we typically have this migratory seasonal run of big eye in close to the main Hawaiian islands. And it's unfortunate now that, if our rules don't get in place that we can borrow some quota, the Western Pacific will be shut down all the way to the calendar year, and we'll lose access to that run of big eye.
But what is interesting, if you can explain, is we'll lose access to it, but it's still there. It means nobody's going to catch it, or the people that are going to catch it are the ones that aren't being monitored like we are.
That's right. Or that school of fish, that large population of fish, will just sort of pass through the main Hawaiian islands and maybe go somewhere down south for spawning, and they'll get caught on the way.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know where necessarily Hawaii big eye come from, which is a problem. We've been arguing and really want more studies on that. So it is an issue with, where our fish come from. If they come from the southern areas in the equatorial Pacific, we know there's a much higher amount of fishing mortality there. Purse seine fisheries up there, they're scooping up the babies.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to get a little bit more information on where our fish come. And the problem is they come from a lot of different areas.
When we say closure, isn't it like the stock market bell at the end of the day? I mean, when that number gets reached, the signal goes out throughout the community right this minute. It's done.
Yeah. And that's so that's for the Hawaii longline fishery, and that's about 140 vessels. And each one of those vessels, you know, represents a business, a small business.
Sure,
you know, some are independently owned, mom and pop type operations, right?
And so, a few are groups. There's a few small groups, but not many.
Sort of majorly consolidated. So they're all small businesses, and when you put people out of work, it does have an impact on the economy. But you know, the trolling guys, the small boat guys, will try and make up some of that gap in the market, and most of that fish might come from the Big Island, or you know, and when that happens, if Big Island picks up their catch of ahi, and that it supplies the Honolulu market,
right,
then the Big Island market gets affected.
Right.
So it's all sort of connected.
Yeah, and actually, you can't blame a fisherman or a processor to send the fish where he can get the most money for
That's
it.
Right.
That's the name of the game. I think what is kind of interesting is this. We see this. We know this goes on. We know that we're very, very regulated, and we're knowing that, I guess in times past, everybody thought, well, this is all this ahi comes down from the Aleutians or comes from the Japanese current, and it comes through, and we just take a little bit, and it keeps going. Even if that is true, it doesn't seem like they're keeping going in the same numbers that they used to.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the history of the catches. And the thing is, we don't have a lot of good information because we're just a small component of the larger picture, right? So every year there's these sort of stock assessments, and the data that you need to do like a major stock assessment for a pan-Pacific population of Big Eye, or even the whole Western Central Pacific, to do it right, you need access to data of basically 10 industrial fleets. You know, you need the Asian distant water longline fleets.
Very good
point. Need the major purse-seine fleets. You need observer coverage. You need tagging studies. You need all these.
It's not to any of their advantage to tell you these numbers.
No, and so there's been a major gap in the data provided by Asian fleets to the scientists. The United States does it, but the whole thing about the United States is that we're a member of these international organizations. They're basically conventions and treaties ratified by Congress. The problem with it is that it's really only impacting U.S. fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
So we've signed up for these things. We are, you know, fulfilling our obligations as contracting members, but we're the only ones, and the only ones really enforcing our fleet. So we're the only ones disadvantaging ourselves for being a member of these international.
And that seems so. You know, horrible sometimes. You know, we are trying, I guess, as best we can, not necessarily because we're good people, but we are doing the right thing because we're being told to, and we're paying attention to the rules. But those that are not get kind of concerning. Is there any confidence in that these things can change over time, that some of these countries will belly up to the bar and realize we have to start restricting some areas and some methods?
I think at this point of the sort of history of the, say, Western Central Pacific Fisheries Commission, it's 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 15 years, the speed that it's taken to get to where we're at provides us little confidence.
Yeah.
I mean, that's in all honesty.
Sure.
There needs to be a lot more work to be done, and in a much more timely manner to get to where we need to be with management of these highly migratory stocks.
You know, you've used the expression stock assessment a lot, and I'm thinking, just based on my exposure to the whole situation in the last couple of years, that these stock assessments are becoming more valuable because they are becoming better. There seems to be some better science going into it, but isn't there also still a long way to go with that as well?
There's a lot of information that goes into stock assessments that are basically data that is created by a scientist. You know, it's assumed information. So there are different parameters of a stock assessment that they look at that if you tweak one of those numbers up or down has a major impact on the outcome of the stock assessment. And a lot of that we just take at face value, but you know, it is the best scientific information available, so
it's
hard to question it. Right?
I got to tell you something, you know, because of the work that you do, you'll like this. On my regular show the other day, we were talking about the hurricanes and these models and how far out they go. And it shows, I think, in this last hurricane in Ignacio, it showed, I think, about 12 different models. And they were all over the park. And you would think, how could they be so different when they're looking at the same numbers? Well, the real answer is they're not looking at the same numbers, right? They're looking at whatever numbers are meaningful to them.
Right. And so what you would hope they would be doing then is taking those 12 models and doing a sort of average of the 12,
right,
and that's
right,
where you sort of get your best estimate. We have one model that uses a lot of different information, but they use different different runs that assume different parameters, which helps.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit more, takes into account some uncertainty. But, you know, fisheries and fishery science is a tough thing to do. It's like, what's that one saying? You know, fisheries is like forestry, except you can't see the trees or count them.
Can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
But what I think is kind of neat to that is that as difficult as it is, it's a measuring stick. It's the only one that you have. And so I'm thinking that... You know, in other words, I'm hoping that what happens is when the local people catch the local fish that they need, that they understand what all of us go through to put that piece of fish on the table. I don't think people still get that, how much action and motion, and like you said earlier, how many people are getting, are counting on this industry.
Yeah, no, it's a major part of our life here in Hawaii. I mean, support local fishermen and their families. It's incredibly important. It's not an easy job. And even if, you know, you're a weekend warrior and you're putting food on the table, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. We don't have anything to worry about in terms of, we think our yellowfin population, Big Eye, is not an issue necessarily from our impact on the stock where we fish here in mm-hmm. Hawaii. Most of the fishing mortality takes a place, you know, along the equator. So where we're fishing, how much we're catching, we're doing okay in Hawaii in terms of pelagics.
Yeah, and Eric Kingma is the International Fisheries Coordinator for the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. We talk a lot about this, and I think what's interesting is, you see, we're talking today about Big Eye and Ahi, and that is the fishery. People need to understand that it's not the mai mai, it's not the ono, it's not the marlin, it's not the shitomi, it's the tuna.
Yeah. If we get further restricted for Hawaii longline Big Eye, if we get our quotas keep going down and down, which the way it looks, it's not getting any better.
It's
going to get worse before it gets better,
yeah, yeah,
which is not a good thing. It's not very optimistic. But it is the Hawaii longline fishery. So if our quota keeps going down for Big Eye, you're going to see less mahi-mahi in the market. You're going to see less ono, less marlins, less opa, less manchong, which a lot of people eat. You know,
yeah, you know, my concern about that is that it seems to be easier to exhaust those species than it is the tuna. It seemingly, I mean, you know, there just seems to be, for whatever the reason, so much more tuna. Why does, scientifically, why is that? Do they grow rapidly? Yeah. Is their strength? Is their mortality low? Why is this tuna the overabundant fish?
Yeah, tuna are highly productive species. Mm-hmm. So they... Not only they reach maturity at a young age, they rapidly reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
So they reproduce more than once in a season, and they reach maturity at maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. So other fish can take a much longer time to reach maturity, and they have different life history, you know, strategies.
Basically. You know, I don't know how old an old tuna is, but I do know that they're not very old.
Well, you look at aku is maybe not living more than 3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Big eyes maybe 10 to 12. Yellowfins maybe half that. So, you know, albacore is a little bit more longer living. And then bluefin is probably the longest living.
You know, let's talk about albacore for a minute. I mean, it's in Hawaii, certainly nowhere near as desirable. The oil content's not the same. The fat content's not the same. But, boy, it's the opposite in certain parts of the mainland, right? Where albacore, whoa, that's the number one.
Yeah, especially up on the west coast of United States, Washington, Oregon, British Columbia. There's been a long time sort of seasonal trolling albacore fishery there.
Sure.
So they use jig rigs or troll surface gear.
You know what it looks like, gang? It looks like these big wide outriggers, and each one of them is running 6 or 7 lines or more.
And they're targeting juvenile fish.
Yeah, yeah.
And those juveniles, because they're feeding in cooler water, more productive water, have a really high fat content, so they're good for, you know, sashimi, for, you know, steaks.
Yeah, for those
also,
folks.
Yeah,
they're not really our choice for sashimi.
No.
But you know, another thing that really surprises some people is when you do catch tombo here, they're kind of big.
Right. So we're probably catching the larger adult sizes that are seasonally going somewhere to spawn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the ones that are catching up at latitudes like, you know, 35 degrees, 40 degrees. those are juveniles. Us catching them down here are probably more the sub-adults or adults.
I do know that people every now and again will come here, and they'll either go on a charter boat or a holo holo, and they'll go and they'll drop bait or they'll jig at a buoy, and they'll catch a 70, 80-pound tumbo, and they think it's a colossus.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how small they were being caught in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, and you know, there's that whole fishery down in similar fishery in New Zealand and the South Pacific too.
Sure.
So they're you know, catching size of maybe 10 to 15 pounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and ours get a whole bunch bigger than that. And it's sort of ironic because you don't normally catch them on troll. You know, I mean, there's, I guess they do come up, but it is way more likely to catch them at 60 or 70 fathoms.
Yeah, here in Hawaii. But up there in cooler waters and in higher latitudes, you're catching them on surface gear like you described.
Is that right? Yeah, it's because surface. The water's colder.
Yeah, so for some reason, the juveniles are up at the surface.
I saw one rig. I'm sure you've seen this many times, but it was at least 12 lines on two big long things that look like outriggers. They were just spreaders.
Yeah.
And as soon as the fish bought a bit, it would break free of the line. The boat would keep going, you know, at the trolling speed, and somebody would either crank that in on a reel or electronically bring it in.
Yeah. No, I think they're fishing. When that kind of fishing's on, it's on. Jig fishing. And it's it's a lot of fun, I've understanding.
Yeah. And there's another thing, too, and this has been true from our Wicked Tuna guys, the north-south, I mean the Outer Banks particularly, is We have been the main developer of the green stick. I mean, it seems to be using more and more. So you find that when creeping into your calculations of gear.
Yeah, and it's an effective gear sometimes, and people don't realize that it can be really productive when you use it right.
Yeah,
when you're in the right conditions. Yeah.
Okay, let's make sure, Eric, that we put the dot the I's and cross the T's on our purpose today was to talk a little bit about what's happening in that part of our fishery that has been closed, and it was closed as of August
5th
for the remainder of this calendar year.
Yeah, so like as I mentioned, I think if our rules go into place, which is currently a public comment period that ends next week, I believe it's the 8th, basically that it will allow Hawaii longline vessels to access some of the U.S. territory quotas. If that goes into effect, probably by the end of September, the Hawaii longline fishery should be able to fish in the West and Central Pacific to the end of the calendar year.
And so that, give us the supply that
right.
we need.
So that means good news for Hawaii local seafood consumers and, you know, the price of ahi towards the end of that Christmas New Year season.
Are you, on a scale of 1 to 10, how comfortable with that coming to be?
I don't know.
Is it pretty difficult?
It's, you know,
there's a lot of variables, I guess.
There's variables. It's the decision rests with the federal government. I think that we have a strong argument to support it. There's currently litigation over the whole framework, and that's a challenge. I think the government has responded well to that litigation, and they're really the plaintiffs are really don't have much leg to stand on in terms of international obligations. We're fully complying with what the legal landscape is in the international arena, and even doing more conservative things. So we're on good standing, good ground with that. So I'm confident. I'd say it's a very good chance that the Hawaii longline vessels will be operating in the Western Central Pacific in October.
And for those of you that are out there, let your representatives know, do whatever you can, because it is our fish and it's our future. And so, you know, if we want to have that fish on the table for Christmas or for any other time, it's going to be on that taking place. Eric Kingma, thank you very much for joining us, as always.
Yeah,
okay, and thank you for listening. We're going to be back again next time. In the meantime, tell absolutely everybody you know, our Go Fish program is heard here weekly, twice a week, on Saturday afternoons at 4, and once again on Sunday mornings at 7. We thank you for listening. If you want to hear something on this Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, drop me an email, themikebuckshow@aol.com. themikebuckshow@aol.com. Have a great rest of your weekend. See you next time on Go Fish.